Okay, we've been looking at this generic bacteria in terms of targets that antibiotics could potentially interact with. And we've looked at cell walls, cell membrane, protein synthesis, and now we're going to spend this day looking at folate synthesis and utilization drugs, those that affect the production and the utilization of folic acid. And then we're going to end looking at a new class of relatively new class of antibiotics, the fluoroquinolones that influence the structure of microbial DNA. So the place we're going to start today is to look at two groups of drugs. In fact, one could almost narrow this to two drugs. Drugs affecting bacterial folic acid synthesis, and then drugs affecting the use of the folic acid that's been produced. And what we are going to focus on is how do these drugs work. We're going to look at how the bugs beat the drugs. We're going to look again at how these are clinically used. And then finally, we're going to consider some of the side effects associated with these drugs. Let me just say that this is where antibiotics really started. They really started with a group of compounds known as sulfonamides. And I just want to give you a trace of history. You don't even have to write this if you choose not to. But let me just tell you how this era came about. It came about and started with a man by the name of Gelmo, 1908. A guy by the name of Gelmo was working in the drug industry in Germany. He was a synthetic chemist, and he made a compound that looks like this. And it became, or its parent name is para-aminosulfonamide. And it became also known, it also became known as sulfanilamide. And he was not interested at all in antimicrobials, but rather was a chemist making precursors that could be used in the synthesis of dyes. Substances in Germany at the time was very much into synthesis of dye-producing agents. In 1932, a man who ultimately won the Nobel Prize for this by the name of Domack took one of these dye substances, and the dye substance he took was this. And I don't know if Dr. Watkins taught you this or not, but you're familiar with Prontosil, but if not, here's the dye substance that he took, and it was a substance called Prontosil. And here's what he did. He took Prontosil, and he pre-treated some mice with this, and then he exposed them to streptococci. And lo and behold, the Prontosil prevented the mice from becoming infected. Then he did the back-assword experiment. He took mice, he gave them the strep, they became infected, and he gave Prontosil, and he showed that Prontosil cured the mice. Well, it was not long thereafter, in 1934, that a Frenchman by the name of Trufuel showed that Prontosil, this dye substance, was metabolically converted to sulfanilamide. And it was really sulfanilamide that was the biologically active compound. And this gave rise then from this simple organic molecule to a ton of compounds all of which vary in terms of this R group. Chemists made thousands and thousands of sulfonamide derivatives. We're going to look at, out of the thousands, we're going to look at four of these compounds. So, with that sort of as invocation, let me just talk you through how these drugs work. And we're going to break it into two pieces. We're going to first look at compounds, and these are going to be sulfonamide compounds, that function to inhibit the synthesis of folic acid. So just to give you a flashback to biochemistry, this is the structure of folic acid. And you can divide this molecule, you can dissect it, into three pieces. There is a left-hand pteridine, a heterocyclic ring system. There's a right-hand glutamic acid, and there's a central molecule, pyraminobenzoic acid. And this is going to be our focus. Pyraminobenzoic acid is the core or central component of folic acid. And we'll see in a second that sulfonamides are anti-metabolites or lookalikes to pyraminobenzoic acid. They look like, they act like, but they do not totally function like pyraminobenzoic acid. Well, in order to understand their mechanism of action, we need to go to the next page and look at what does folic acid do in the cell? And I'm sure you've had this in biochemistry, but let me just quickly review it for you in a very simple schematic. Here's the synthesis. But once folic acid is synthesized, constructed, in order for it to be effective, it has to be reduced to tetrahydrofolic acid. And it's tetrahydrofolic acid that gets converted to various cofactors. And these cofactors function in one carbon transfer reactions. Folic acid is a cofactor in a range of critical one carbon transfer reactions. And here's a few examples thereof. So activated reduced tetrahydrofolic acid as a cofactor is involved in the synthesis of thymidine, which goes into the construction, the building of DNA. And this reaction is shown here on the right because it's a pivotal reaction. It's going to be hit with antifungals. It's going to be a target for anti-cancer. We're going to see it over and over again. So here's how it works. Here's deoxyuridylic acid. Here is the activated form of tetrahydrofolic acid. It happens to be N5N10-methylene tetrahydrofolic acid. This functions as a cofactor along with the enzyme thymidylic synthetase. And thymidylic synthetase takes the cofactor, transfers this carbon to this 5 position, producing thymidylic acid. So all one is doing is, through this reaction, transferring the carbon from the activated form of tetrahydrofolic acid to the substrate. And here's the introduction of the carbon, i.e. thymidine, which then gets activated and incorporated into DNA. In this process, the folic acid gets oxidized and has to be re-reduced, and we'll come back to that. Well, activated folic acid, or reduced tetrahydrofolic acid molecules, or cofactors, are also involved in the synthesis of purines. They're involved in the synthesis of certain amino acids, methionine and glycine. So in the economy of the cell, reduced folic acid is critical in carrying out some strategic biochemical processes without which the cell could not sustain itself. Well, if that is the role of folic acid in the cell, and these compounds are inhibitors of the to carry out these reactions. And so one can look at then, how do sulfonamides work and how do they inhibit the synthesis of the folic acid? And let me describe it first in this molecule, how the molecule is built. The molecule is going to be built by the introduction first, the building of the pteridine part, then the introduction of the pyraminobenzoic acid, then the introduction of the glutamic acid, and then reducing that product, which is dihydrofolic acid, down to tetrahydrofolic acid. So we're going to build it left to right, and we're going to now look to see how this sulfonamide molecule, which looks remarkably similar to that of pyraminobenzoic acid, interferes with this process. One other thing you need to know, this is pyraminobenzoic acid, or it is a weak acid. This proton, or this hydrogen, or if you like, this hydrogen, is weakly acidic. So it behaves like the normal substrate, i.e., it also is a weak acid. So, in terms of the synthesis of the folic acid, then, here's what's happening. The pteridine combines with the pyraminobenzoic acid, producing dihydroteroic acid. And this enzyme that carries out this step is the enzyme dihydroteroate synthetase. It is a synthetase enzyme that puts the pteridine plus the pyraminobenzoic acid together. That produces the left and the middle portion. Then the glutamic acid is introduced, producing dihydrofolic acid. And the dihydrofolic acid, as we'll see in a bit, has to be reduced to tetrahydrofolic acid. And this is an NADPH-mediated reaction catalyzed by dihydrofolate reductase producing the necessary tetrahydrofolic acid that then can be activated and carry out its role in one carbon transfer reactions. Sulfonamides function as competitive inhibitors of dihydroteroate synthetase. That is, they compete with the normal substrate, pyraminobenzoic acid, for the active site of the synthetase. Let me just show you some molecules as to how this baby works. This is pyraminobenzoic acid. This is the normal substrate. So this is the amino group. Here's the acid. Oxygen is red. The nitrogen is blue. Here's the pyraminobenzoic acid. And here's the normal substrate that sits on the active site of the enzyme. Here is a sulfonamide, a generic sulfonamide. The aromatic ring, the amino group, not very flexible here, and the sulfonic acid or the sulfonamide moiety. And this also has the ability to sit, to position itself on the active site of the enzyme. And if you look here, there are two peas in a pod. They literally fit on each other. So the normal substrate or the sulfonamide can compete for binding, I can't do this very well, to the active site of the enzyme and compete effectively against pyraminobenzoic acid because it possesses the required structural feature or configuration to competitively inhibit. And that's how it functions. So you can look at this if you like. I hope you don't get a rash back to organic chemistry. But so then the question becomes, if indeed synthesis of folic acid is how these molecules work, then why are they selectively toxic? What is it that makes them selectively toxic to bacteria? And here's the story. And this is sort of a neat example of selective toxicity. Bacteria must synthesize folic acid from scratch. Bacteria are unable to actively accumulate folic acid. You, on the other hand, derive your folic acid from nutrients, foodstuffs, and you have an active mechanism for taking up preformed, fully synthesized folic acid from your diet. Thus, sulfonamides inhibit bugs that have to make it. Sulfonamides have little or no effect on you because you are getting your folic acid from dietary substances or sources. And that's the basis for the selective toxicity. Now, over the years, what has happened with the use of sulfonamides, several things have contributed dramatically to a decrease in their utilization. They're still used in the developed world or the developing world, not in the developed world, primarily because they are very inexpensive, they are totally synthetic, but over time, organisms have become resistant to them, and better drugs have become available, and we'll see in a bit that their use, even in the developing world, is very limited. And it's limited to the treatment of ocular infections, and it's limited to the treatment of urinary tract infections. One of the things that has contributed to the decrease use of these compounds is resistance. Bacteria have become increasingly resistant to sulfonamides, and they do it in multiple ways, two of which: they inactivate the drug, they increasingly inactivate the drug, and they do it by the process of N-acetylation. So bacteria have N-acetyl transferase enzymes that acetylate the N4 nitrogen. There's two nitrogens here in this molecule, and they're distinguished, this being referred to as N1, this being referred to as N4, and this is the site of inactivation. So one way that bacteria overcome the presence of sulfonamides or become resistant is to inactivate, and they inactivate by N4 acetylation. The second way that it happens, or can happen, is as a result of decreased or altered affinity of dihydroterylate synthetase for the sulfonamide. Or if you like, going back to the day one, altered binding to an active site. Now, let me say something about the the enzyme altered affinity for dihydroterylate synthetase, the active site of the enzyme that would incorporate the pyraminobenzoic acid. Okay. In other words, it fits. It no longer has affinity and can't is as effectively compete for the active site with pyrimenobenzoic acid. In terms of their pharmacology, let me tell you one other piece of information that you need to know, and then we'll talk through their pharmacology. I indicated that this hydrogen, or if you like, this hydrogen is acidic. So all of these sulfonamides that we're going to talk about are salts. They're sodium salts, they're potassium salts, typically. The sulfonamides that clinically are used are all orally active. And we're going to talk generically here, and then I'll talk down, or show you the specific compounds and how they're used. All of these drugs are orally active, and they're well absorbed from the intestine. They extensively distribute to tissues, to fluids, including crossing the blood-brain barrier into the central nervous system. They are not effective against most pathogens responsible for central infections. So although they get there, they're not used because they're ineffective. So they widely distribute to tissues and fluids. They undergo metabolism by the liver, and the metabolism that the liver carries out is N-acetylation at the N4 nitrogen. Some drugs are metabolized to a greater extent than others. The drug and metabolite that is produced is eliminated by the kidneys. And concentrations in the urine of these compounds, because they are weak acids, can be 20, 30, 40 times the plasma concentration. Thus, one of the areas that they have been effective in is in the management or treatment of urinary tract infections. Now, I haven't said anything about cytostatic. In general, these drugs are bacteriostatic agents. Now, here's, I think, the caveat. The caveat is, yes, they are bacteriostatic agents by definition, but the concentration that one achieves in the urinary tract with these drugs, where they are concentrated, may very well produce a acidal effect. Jack up that concentration 25 times and the drug becomes acidal. Now, if indeed that is the case, one other thing needs to be known. Since they are weak acids, they're going to be water soluble. They are also going to be substrates for active tubular secretion. And so, like penicillins, they are eliminated both by glomerular filtration, but they're also, because this is acidic, substrates for the acid secretory pump in the proximal tubule. There are four sulfonamides that we're going to simply focus on, and then I'm going to jump to the clinical utilization. But just to show you, I said all of these compounds that are used currently are variations on this substitution at R. So here's one example, sulfamethazole, sulfadiazine, sulfisoxazole, sulfacetamide. They are all variations on that simple changing that R group. And that has led to a number of sulfonamide compounds, and let me just point out a few of these to you, okay? and then we'll go to really the major use of sulfonamides. Sulfacetamide is a form of sulfonamide that is used to treat trachoma. It's used topically to treat bacterial infections, blepharitis, conjunctivitis, but particularly has activity against Chlamydia trachomatis. Sulfadiazine is a sulfa that has been used topically to prevent infections in burn patients, and it is typically used as the silver salt of sulfadiazine. So this can be used to treat superficial infections, but particularly has had utility in treatment and or prevention of infections in burn patients, and it is used as the silver salt, and silver has antimicrobial activity. We're going to skip this one and go to sulfasalazine, which we will visit. This is a sulfa drug, but this sulfa drug is not used to treat infections, but rather, we will come back to it in December, it is used in the management of ulcerative colitis. It is a sulfa that bacteria take and cleave into sulfapyridine and an anti-inflammatory sulfonic or salicylic acid known as 5-aminosalicylic acid. We will revisit this when we talk about the management of ulcerative colitis. And then there's one other sulfa here, probably the developing world would be the most commonly used sulfisoxazole, and it's most commonly used because of its solubility characteristics. We'll see why in just a second. To treat urinary tract infections. There's one other preparation that I have not talked about, and I will come back to it. And that is, there is a sulfa that is used in a combination drug along with a compound called trimethoprim. We'll come back to this because this is going to be, for you, the major use of sulfonamides clinically. And this drug simply has the requisite pharmacokinetic properties to make it effective. So, of the clinically useful drugs, a topical, a couple used to treat urinary tract infections and skin infections really sort of rounds out the repertoire. Now, if you look to see what are the side effects, part of the reason that these drugs have diminished in use is the result of side effects. There are hypersensitivity reactions. Somewhere between 2-3% of individuals that are treated with sulfonamide drugs will develop skin hypersensitivity reactions. These can be mild rashes. They can even be life-threatening Steven Johnson syndrome, which is an exfoliation of the skin. There is some evidence that would suggest that it's not the sulfonamide itself, but rather oxidation products that are responsible for the hypersensitivity reaction. And there's some data that would suggest that individuals that are slow acetylators may be more prone to hypersensitivity reactions. That is, those that slowly metabolize the drug allow for the generation, the production of more oxidant species or oxidation breakdown products than those that are rapid acetylators of the drugs. Now, one of the things that you will read and be advised about is the potential for cross hypersensitivity. I don't have the time to develop all of the sulfonamide therapeutic agents that you're going to be using clinically, but let me just give you a few. There are many sulfonamides that are available clinically, and so the concern was, if Susie Q is hypersensitive to a sulfonamide antibacterial, might she also show cross-hypersensitivity to other sulfonamide therapeutic agents? Let me just give you a few. Thiazides, your diuretic friends, are sulfonamide-containing compounds. Diamox, the carbotic anhydrase inhibitor, is a sulfonamide. Tolbutamide, an oral hypoglycemic agent, is a sulfonamide. Celebrex, the designer anti-inflammatory compound, is a sulfonamide. You don't have to write all of these down. The fact is, there are many therapeutic agents that you're going to be used that are sulfonamides, and the question is there cross-hypersensitivity? And the data would suggest no. But individuals that are prone to hypersensitivity reactions will be more prone to exhibit them to sulfonamide drugs. In addition, these compounds have some other side effects. One is crystallinuria. That is, their solubility characteristics are such, now think of this, they're weak acids. So urine is acidic, and you know from your chemistry that you can precipitate acids out in an acidic environment. And so these have poor solubility characteristics in acidic urine, and as a result, want to crystallize out in the kidneys. This is called crystallinuria, and I said that sulfisoxazole was one sulfonamide that had the best solubility characteristics in urine, that is, diminished crystallinuria. And so what was happening is chemists were varying this R group to produce compounds that had better solubility. Yes? Sulfisoxazole. You may know it. I don't know if you're familiar with Gantrisin is the trade name for it, has the best solubility characteristic. Now, sulfonamides have one other, I'm going to mention it, we will visit it in a couple weeks. One other property, and that is they have the potential to produce hemolytic anemia, destruction of red blood cells. And this is particularly seen or more likely to occur in individuals that are glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficient. Sulfonamides act like a drug we will visit when we talk about malaria called primaquine, which also causes hemolytic anemia, and we'll look at the mechanism and why, okay, when we get there. It's not unique to sulfonamides. Any drug that potentially can oxidatively stress a red blood cell can lead to hemolytic anemia. There are several other problems related or adverse effects, or if you like, drug-drug interactions that come about because of the sulfonamides or use of sulfonamides. And all of these, next, this couplet, are the result of drug-drug interactions leading to potentiation. Sulfonamides, when given, I said distribute all over the body, including into the central nervous system. But sulfonamides also, depending on the drug, have great affinity for albumin. They are bound very highly to albumin. And they share binding sites on that albumin with other drugs. And in fact, sulfonamides share those binding sites and have greater affinity for them than other drugs, thereby displacing the drug that has the lower affinity. Let me give you a couple examples thereof. All of these are the same story, okay? There is a disorder called kernicterus, and it occurs in newborns and very young children as a result of increased amounts of bilirubin in the circulation. And the bilirubin cannot be eliminated, and therefore it crosses the blood-brain barrier and is deposited in the basal ganglia, causing a neurological disorder called kernicterus. And here's how it occurs. In newborns, the bilirubin is bound to albumin. Now if you, and let's just say the bilirubin is 99% bound, 1% free. Now if you introduce a sulfonamide and you displace some of the bilirubin off of that albumin binding site, you can change the free concentration from 1% to 4 or 5%, and in the poorly developed central nervous system, that can lead to passage across the blood-brain barrier, depositing in a neurological disorder. Let me give you an example with a drug. Now, all of the drugs that do this are drugs that are highly bound. This doesn't happen with a drug that's 5%. They're highly bound. And these invariably, because you've seen them all before multiple times, these invariably are drugs that have fairly narrow therapeutic indices. So I'll just pick one here. It doesn't really matter. Okay, let's take tolbutamide. Tolbutamide is an oral hypoglycemic agent. Its role is to drop the blood sugar down. It's used in the management of diabetes, particularly type 2. It's bound tightly to albumin. Now let's just say Jocko has his tolbutamide, his diabetes is being managed, but he develops a urinary tract infection. And the physician prescribes a sulfonamide. The sulfonamide that is prescribed may very well have greater affinity for the binding site on albumin and displace off tolbutamide. So the tolbutamide concentration goes from this to this. And Jocko goes into hypoglycemic shock. So all of these are the result of drug-drug interactions where the sulfonamide and the drug in question share a common binding site on albumin, and displacement leads to increased concentration and potentiation of the response. Okay, I'd like to, if you can grit your teeth and hold your bladder, get through one other piece before we take a break, and that is, we have talked about sulfonamides that inhibit the synthesis of folic acid and work because bugs make it and you don't. Now we're going to talk about, I'm going to just briefly develop another drug for you, and then we're going to put two of these drugs together into what's going to be a very potent combination. There is a drug called trimethoprim. And this is the structure of trimethoprim. This was, in contrast to so much of pharmacology, a rationally designed drug. Trimethoprim was rationally designed as a result of studies that showed that dihydrofolate reductase, the enzyme that reduces dihydrofolic acid to tetrahydrofolic acid, was different structurally and functionally in different species. And so the question then arose, could one design a compound that would selectively inhibit dihydrofolate reductase in microorganisms and have little or no effect on this critical enzyme that's present in your bod? And the drug that was designed was trimethoprim. And in fact, the people that designed this designed several other variations on this theme and won the Nobel Prize in the late 1980s. Here's how it works. We said that in order for folic acid to be used, it had to be in this form. In order to get from dihydro to tetrahydro, it has to be reduced, and here's the reaction. So it is reduced, It is reduced from the dihydro here to the tetrahydro here, and the enzyme is dihydrofolate reductase. Trimethoprim is a selective inhibitor of microbial and particularly bacterial dihydrofolate reductase. The difference in enzyme structure function allows for selective inhibition. And if you just look here, you can see how this plays out. Just look at one or two entries here. If you isolate this enzyme from a bacterial source, let's just say E. coli, and you isolate this enzyme from a human cell source, and you ask the question, what concentration of trimethoprim is required to inhibit 50%? What concentration of drug to inhibit the enzyme 50%? And if you look here, you can see that the concentration that inhibits E. coli is 60,000 times lower than the concentration required to inhibit the human form of the enzyme. And that's the basis for the selective toxicity. One can therapeutically administer this drug at a dose that will inhibit dihydrofolate reductase in bacteria, leaving the organism or the host cell untouched. Let me say one other thing about trimethoprim, and then I want to put it together in a preparation for you.
I'm sorry, is that a competitive
It's a competitive inhibitor. Yes, that's a great question, okay? And you'll see why in just a second, okay? Okay, one other thing about trimethoprim, and that is, although it may be listed here as used therapeutically, it has some activity in the urinary tract and to treat prostatitis, the reality is it is always used in combination with a sulfonamide. Okay? It is always used in combination with a sulfonamide. And the sulfonamide trimethoprim combination that is used, you may know of as Bactrim or Septra. Those are the trade names. It is now generic, and it is called cotrimoxazole. So cotrimoxazole has a sulfonamide in a certain dose. In fact, 400 milligrams of the sulfonamide And it has trimethoprim, these are now in the same tablet, 80 milligrams, and this combination, when absorbed, distributed, and at peak blood concentration, gives a ratio of about one part of trimethoprim to 20 parts of the sulfa, and that has been shown to be optimally synergistic. Okay? So if indeed the combination is synergistic, how does the combination work? And here's how it works. The sulfonamide that's chosen from thousands, was a sulfonamide that had the same pharmacokinetic properties as trimethoprim. And the one that fit the bill was the compound sulfamethoxazole. So here's how it works. The sulfa, as we saw, is a competitive inhibitor of dihydroteroate synthetase, and trimethoprim is a competitive inhibitor of dihydrofolate reductase. Put the two together, and one observes a synergistic response. Put the two together, and one ends up having a preparation that is useful against a whole range of important pathogens. And this is where it's used, yes.
So the two of those together would be bactericidal?
Ah, good question, yeah. So since you asked it, I will answer and then I'm going to ask you a question, okay? And you can get your friends to help you. Yes, the answer is the combination is bactericidal, okay? The combination is synergistic. What accounts for the synergism? You can think about it, okay? Why is this combination synergistic? Now, don't give me the crapola. This inhibited and this inhibited leads to. No, I want to know why it is synergistic, okay? You can think about it. Okay. We have one other part to look at, and that is, okay, if this, now, we have a sulfonamide and an inhibitor of dihydrofolate reductase. What's the spectrum of activity? What's the clinical use of this preparation? And you can see it's quite extensive. It's used to treat listeria. It's an alternative to ampicillin. It has particularly activity here. Gram-negative rods. It's used in the treatment of prostate and urinary tract infections. Trimethoprim is a weak base. Prostatic fluid is acidic. Thus, trimethoprim localizes, concentrates in prostatic fluid and becomes effective in the treatment of prostatitis. It's effective in the treatment of urinary tract infections. It has been used in the treatment of various GI infections and has some activity in respiratory tract infections. Probably not first-line drugs here, but certainly activity against Haemophilus and Legionella. Legionella would be preferentially or preferably treated with an erythromycin derivative. And then very importantly, this preparation is the preferred drug for the treatment as well as the prevention of pneumocystis. Pneumocystis pneumonia, the most common opportunistic infection in immunocompromised patients and certainly AIDS patients, this is the preparation of choice for both prophylaxis as well as treatment. Let me say something about side effects, and then we will take a break here in terms of sulfonamides. Hypersensitivity is most likely the result of the sulfa preparation in the combination. There are also hematological effects. In individuals that are malnourished or in alcoholics, this combination can lead to megaloblastic anemia. And this megaloblastic anemia is the result of folic deficiency. So people that are borderline malnourished or folate deficient can, in the presence of this combination drug, be driven to a more deficient state, leading to the development of megaloblastic anemia. It is possible to reverse that effect by giving a compound that bypasses the enzymatic blockades. I want to introduce it now because we're going to talk about it a lot. And there are two compounds or two preparations that are capable of doing this. That is, of overcoming the folate deficiency, the folate blockade, both at synthesis as well as reduction. One preparation or one name for this, it's the same compound, is called folinic acid. It's also known as leucovorin. And it is N5-4-methyltetrahydrofolic acid. This is a activated form of tetrahydrofolic acid that bypasses both steps in the blockade and allows for the reversal of the megaloblastic anemia. Remember these because we're going to see it over and over again when we get to cancer chemotherapy and with other compounds. Yes? Oh, bless her. Okay. Here I thought you said question. Okay. Two other things and we're going to quit. Gastrointestinal, there's some GI upset, there's some nausea. These tend to be managed side effects. And then what one sees also is drug interactions. Because of the sulfa, one has the potential again for displacement, potentiation, because of shared albumin binding sites. The major use of sulfonamides in the developed world is in this preparation. You've been very kind. I've rambled on here. There's just too much. Let's take a break, and then we will come back, and we will look at fluoroquinolones and one other drug. Resistance with trimethoprim is altered dihydrofolate reductase.